This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it, and I find myself staying up late to catch all the action. I can't be dragging the next morning. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or when my favorite team is playing late. With over 15 flavors to choose from, like watermelon, tropical burst, blue raspberry, peach mango, and more, there's a flavor for everyone. On their website, you have the option to build your own 12-pack or 24-pack and have it delivered right to your door. And if you're out and about, you can always pick up a 5-hour energy shot at your local grocery or convenience store. They're everywhere. 5-Hour Energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before the next tip-off.
Hey, it's Gemma Spegg, host of the Open Mind Original podcast, Mantra. Every Monday, I'll bring you a new mantra, a simple yet powerful phrase to help you clear your mind and stay grounded amidst the chaos. I'll also share some personal stories, journal prompts, and a weekly challenge to bring each mantra to life. Follow and listen to Mantra, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Open Mind Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Doing something a little bit different today here on the show. I think the third person ever in my home studio, Sam Fortier, is here.
Wow, thank you for having me. This is incredibly impressive for everyone that's listening. This studio is sick.
Thank you. I've spent probably far too much of my own money on it, but that's okay. We don't need to talk about that. We are, however, Sam Fortier, going to talk about people spending money, specifically people with a lot more of it than me. What we want to talk about today, kind of in podcast long form, is how much ownership really impacts the NFL, because I feel like this is an underlying narrative for a lot of the NFL offseason when it comes to everything from kind of the prestige of certain teams and who wants to play where, but also the actual contract structures, which I think has been talked a lot about in the last 18 months as Philadelphia has built their behemoth. Obviously, they've drafted really well, but the way they've structured so many things, the way they're able to keep so much of their talent, everyone's like, oh, no one can do it like the Eagles. And it's like, well, why not? So I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about sports ownership and how much it matters. I have far beyond the NFL, but considering that is kind of our shared beat here, I passed on the baton, the Syracuse baton to you as I left the beat a couple of years ago, and you've carried it valiantly, might I say.
Thank you.
When you think of like the thing from an ownership perspective that has the biggest impact on building a winner in the NFL, what's like the number one thing on the list?
There's a lot here, and I think the NFL is actually a really interesting, unique structure because there are sports like the English Premier League or MLB where ownership has a more direct impact on winning because they don't have salary caps and, you know, the transfer window in the EPL. Like how much money you spend on your players has a direct impact on the team you're able to field, whereas in the NFL with a hard salary cap, it's you're more constrained, and so you have to win more on the edges. And I think one of those edges is cash versus cap. You know, the salary cap is basically an accounting mechanism. The cash is how much money you're spending on a year-to-year basis, you know, actually paying to players. And I think cash flow is the thing that's probably under-discussed in terms of what ownership is able to do. I think it's not probably the number one thing. You know, I remember being in the tunnel below Raymond James Stadium when the Commanders beat the Bucks in the playoffs, and Magic Johnson was basically hyping up Josh Harris, and he was like, you know, this is the guy that does it. And Josh Harris was like, talent, culture, people. I think those things are probably, you know, in some range, like those are the three most important things that you can do as an owner. But when you look at, you know, what is quantifiable, which, you know, I know Josh Harris loves, yeah, then I think it's really cash spending per year. And it's the NFLPA report card. Like, what are you doing as an owner to help your team in the best position. There's also other, you know, ancillary benefits like health and sports science and analytics. What can you do on the edges? But I do think the two main things, if you're a fan and you're looking at how, what is the owner of my team doing, the NFLPA report card and cash spending is a great place to start.
So we'll circle back to the cap cash thing because I think that gets really hairy. And I do actually want to get into the details of it, which is kind of fun, something we typically wouldn't do on a radio show. But, hey, you know, this radio show is different than other radio shows. We have guests in our loft home studio. The person side of it, like that to me is the easiest thing to explain. And I feel like, I'm curious what you feel first watching Washington stuff from the outside when you were covering the Chargers and just generally watching football before you even got into the professional writing of it all versus when you like got here. But I think my view of it as someone who's on the beat watching the Bruce Allen era puke all over itself at all times was like, fans didn't fully appreciate how much that was an ownership problem. That it was almost like, we keep hiring bad GMs and it's unlucky that these guys suck. And it's like, no. There's a common thread throughout this. The football incompetence was actually directly tied to Dan Snyder in a way that I don't know that fans fully appreciated at the time. And I think the longer it went on, the more they appreciated it, the smarter everyone got, and the more hip people got to the challenges and the realities of how bad an incompetent owner is, because ultimately their number one job is hiring good people. And that is something that Josh Harris talked about. It's why almost nobody was kept from the previous regimes on either the business or the football side, is because occasionally would you get lucky and there's someone local who grew up, you know, dreaming of working for the Commanders organization and dealt with the nonsense that was Snyder. Yeah, there were certainly good people that worked here. So if any former employees are listening that I know and I like and that were good at their jobs, I'm not talking about you. But there were certainly a lot of people that had no business in, maybe they could have worked in sports or worked in the organization, but not at the positions that they were. And so you wind up over hiring, you wind up not getting the best talent. And I think that is how you wind up with so many of the bad personnel people that you had in Washington. And then you see how quickly, once you get Adam Peters, obviously never would have worked here under Dan Snyder. You get Peters and then see what Peters does with Newmark and on down the list. And that is the most immediate impact before you even get to anything structurally with contracts and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. I think putting those people in place and trusting their judgment and kind of taking a step away. You know, Josh Harris has that reputation, especially even from Philly. Like, you hire Daryl Morey, you hire Sam Hinkie. Like, you hire a strong, smart sports executive and you kind of let him do his thing. And so I think the ability to empower those people, I think we've seen that here. It's fostering a culture of, hey, we're going to give you the money you need. We're going to do the things, you know, on the edges that try to win. And we're going to put those right people in place and trust their judgment. And so I think that, you know, having a clear also division of labor and having everybody understand their roles, like, hey, you know, I think Dan Snyder putting Ron Rivera in charge of personnel executive decisions, that's a thing that, like, Ron probably asked for it, you know, when he was first hired, but it's, hey, he didn't have a ton of experience doing that. Now it's,
that's why they were able to hire him, right?
It's right.
Like, you know, say what you want about Ron now, and boy, have I said a lot of things about Ron Rivera. But like at the time coming off of Carolina, his reputation in the league was still pretty good. Now, whether it should have been, I think is arguable based off of his results in Carolina, but he certainly, like, without hesitation, didn't even put himself on the market and chose Washington because he got a job in Washington he couldn't get anywhere else.
Right. And so if you're operating as Dan Snyder was from a reputational disadvantage, you have to do things like that to get people in the door, or you're overpaying free agents or over the hill free agents. And so, you know, I think we're seeing it this year. How many, you know, Commanders free agent Zooms have I been on where they say, you know, the money is obviously an important factor, but coming to a team that can be competitive, that has a young quarterback, that has Adam Peters, you know, Javon Kinlaw specific, like, I asked him, why Washington? He said, Adam Peters, of course. Like, having a architect of the roster that can come in and build this thing in a smart, responsible way, players see that. And so I think that, like, to your point earlier, when I was growing up, like, watching sports, if my favorite team was performing poorly, I was just like, oh, these players, these coaches, they're making the wrong decisions. It's so much of what you don't see influences what you see, that the closer I get, the more I write about this stuff, the more I learn about it, I'm like, the line from what the owner does to the fans' experience is direct. Obviously, it gets filtered through those people, but what the owner is doing has such a large influence on the fans' consumption of the product. Commanders fans obviously know that from years here, but it was something that, like, growing up, if you didn't have a cartoonishly villainous owner or have, like, a guy who was just doing it all to try to win or, and is very public, that it's hard to see that sometimes.
For sure. To use the filter analogy, like directly, right? If we think of it as like water or liquid going through the filters and like what's at the bottom, like you can yell at the filters or you can yell at the guy who changes the filters. And like the owner's the guy that changes the filters. And to take it out of Washington for a second, one of the really eye-opening owner type of things that happened this offseason for me was I happened to be just watching NFL Network the day that the Jags fired Peterson, and they had the first press conference, right? So it's Shad Khan and it's Trent Baalke. And listening to the disconnect of the way Shad Khan sees a football organization get built versus how the cohesion and the togetherness and what's their alignment? Is that their word or the Wizards' word?
I think alignment is a Commander's word as well.
Okay, I can't remember.
A lot of organizations are using alignment.
There's so much cross. It's so funny because like there's so much crossover in how the Wizards and the Commanders are both doing things, except for the Commanders got the number two pick in the right draft and the Wizards are very much hoping they get the number one pick in this draft and they can get Cooper Flagg and they can then have the talent. So it's like they're doing very similar things. One just has talent, one doesn't, and one is basketball and one is football. So they're very different ecosystems. But point being, like the alignment that they have between coach and GM here that is set forth by the owner who is also on the same page versus Shad Khan in Jacksonville being like, oh no, it's a positive that both the coach and the GM will report to me. And it's like, no, man, you know nothing about what they're reporting on. And that means they're on different pages. That's a bug, not a feature, my guy. And so like, I think even that level of understanding, and we talk about the hiring, right? You have to understand what characteristics you're actually looking for. And you have to do that knowing that like, there's only so much you're going to be able to evaluate a scout, right? The scouting side of the GM job. Like Adam Peters did not get into, and maybe he did with, who was it? Rick Spielman. Right, that they used in the hiring process.
Yeah.
And so maybe Josh gets someone like Rick Spielman and is like, okay, I want you to sit down and watch tape with the guy and tell me that he's not a Looney Tune. Okay, fine. But Josh Harris isn't watching tape with Adam Peters being like, actually, I don't like the way you look at running backs. So like there's parts of the job from a leadership and organizational communications, that standpoint, that absolutely someone like a Josh Harris or a Shad Khan should be able to understand. But there's other parts of the job that you have to simply get out of the way of and make sure that you're hiring, I guess, someone based off resume and track record as well.
Right. And I think that's why at the combine last year, knowing they have the number two pick, knowing it's going to be a quarterback and how important that position is, Josh Harris sits in on the combine interviews and I think is studying, hey, these are the people I picked. How are they approaching probably the most consequential decision that this organization will make in a while? And I think, and then I, you know, kind of shift over to a longtime owner in John Mara of the New York Giants, you know, the kind of a co-owner, but like for him to come out and say, oh, I have been too hair trigger in the past with firings, and I want to give Daboll and Shane an opportunity this season to dig themselves out of it, or to, you know, to show us what they can do. Like, I think that is a fascinating position because you're seeing an owner kind of grapple with, you know, previous mistakes, which is not, I think, a level of self-reflection you often get from people like that. But to me, like, that's a fascinating position for them to be in, because now Daboll and Shane know, hey, we could have been fired last year. The owner is giving us a longer leash. We need to like really make this worth it. And so that's the sort of situation where when you're watching the Giants this year, when you're watching them in the draft, that informs the context of like the decisions that they make.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I also think that that actually reminded me of something that we've talked about a lot on the show when it comes to team building. And I think the current silliest piece of, I'm going to use silliest instead of dumbest. I'm going to try to be nice today. The silliest piece of analysis currently going is the obsession over how things are getting done versus what is being done. And I think particularly we're guilty of this in Washington sometimes where it's like, would Dan Snyder have done that? And there is a difference in like, would Dan Snyder have chosen the same path versus would Dan Snyder have made the same decisions on the path? So you bring up last year, Josh Harris sitting in on the quarterback meetings. I was fine with that because he's Josh Harris and not Dan Snyder. Josh Harris is going to know his place in that meeting. He's also going to know his place after that meeting. He's not going to try to insert himself and be the main guy, but this is someone who's been incredibly successful and asks smart questions. That is why Josh Harris has been a good sports owner, is he asks the right people the right questions and is able to ascertain what he needs and also maybe make them think about something a little bit differently. Like, we've all been asked questions by smart people that make us reflect and go like, wow, okay, do I actually want to either defend that position, or like, this is why I went in explaining it, in teaching someone about something. Maybe I learned something about that thing myself. And like, Josh Harris will ask those kinds of questions. Dan Snyder will not. And so whether it's the trade versus free agency versus draft discussion, whether it's, so, you know, how involved is the owner in X, Y, or Z decision? I also think that like, sometimes we overrate the how and the processes of these things. Sure, they matter. But like, there is also, I think, within sports, beyond the money, which we're going to circle back to here finally in a second, just a pure skill level, in the same way that the skill level in everything in life. Some people are better writers than others. Some people are better basketball players than others. Some people are better accountants than others. Some people are good salespeople. Some people are good sales managers. And those two things aren't necessarily the same. And I think because we just see them as a bunch of rich guys, and unfortunately still at this point, mostly guys, although other sports are starting to be more female owners too, like, there is just this reality that there's going to be some people that are better at this than others. And I think that's part of the fun of like talking out this when it comes to the NFL specifically, is like, you look at Khan versus Harris and it's like, yeah, Harris is just better at being an owner.
Yeah. And I think that like the fascinating part to me is that especially the new generation of owners, the old, you know, the old family money, the Rooneys, the Maras, you know, kind of grew up on the racetrack and own these teams because they love the sport, the sportsmen, like that's being replaced by the hedge fund guys, the private equity guys. I think, you know, obviously the NFL is now allowing institutional capital. So who an owner is even changing. But to your point, it still matters, the individual. Like, the thing that's fascinating to me about sports and this new wave of owners is you cannot buy success in the same way that people have bought success in business. Like, when you look at David Tepper, who owns the Panthers,
yeah,
hedge fund billionaire, so successful, has been really, really good you know, at the markets for a long time, at business for a long time. And you come into the NFL, and he's like, and it's like, oh, I can't just throw a bag at Matt Rhule. I can't just throw a bag at X player in free agency and fix this. It's a really complicated, fine-tuned people business. And I think that like, when I first started covering the NFL and you hear coaches or GMs or owners say it's a people business, I always thought that, you know, it was a little trite. It was a little coach speak, that they were just trying to not answer the question. And now I think I appreciate to a greater degree how much of a people business this is. Because when you hire Adam Peters and you have a good reputation and then you go get these certain players, and there's always going to be a business element. There's always going to be, hey, you know, Jonathan Allen, he's been a great player for this franchise for a long time, but he does not fit into our vision at this number for the future. Then you have to, you know, maybe look somewhere else. But the handling things the right way and releasing him a couple days before free agency that gives him a heads up, like that small thing I think is important, or reworking someone's contract. And so watching owners who have always, they know money, but do they know people? I think that's what delineates these guys at the highest level, at the most competitive league, or one of the most, you know, the most competitively balanced league around.
Yeah, I think the other side of that too, which I think a guy like Harris actually, and this is not meant to just say that Josh Harris has done everything right and he will do everything right forever. So everyone over in Ashburn, this isn't a free pass forever. Not from these two journalists. But like, one thing that I think Harris has balanced really well is kind of the analytics, the business, the hardcore, like black and white of it all with the gray area of the people, right? And I think you and I often, like we in talking, I've talked about sports enough with you on and off the air that like, I think we see a lot of things very similarly, and like we find data very, very, very helpful. But the thing about data is you have to understand the context of it. Numbers by themselves on a page don't help you very much. And so like, for instance, Bobby Wagner's a really great example of this. They re-sign Bobby Wagner and you can be like, oh, he's a little bit slower. Like the stopwatch doesn't lie. Okay, fine. But if I tell you that defense is primarily about assignment and alignment, and Bobby Wagner understands assignment and where not just he, but everybody on the defense needs to line up, how do you put that into data? And like, I think if a coach had told me that 7 years ago, I would have been like, you're way too high on your own supply. Like, this is all mushy coach. Like, you think you're in a movie type stuff. And then the more you watch it and the more you appreciate it, the more you're around it, the more you see the truth in that kind of stuff. That, like, there are truly things that aren't measured on the stat sheet, if you will, with the exception that the final score is in the stat sheet. And, like, Bobby Wagner's always on winning teams. Why is that? Because he's a force multiplier on everyone else. And so, like, I think that fine line too, when you talk about the skill of the owner, how much do they care about the data, how data driven are they versus understanding the human element, how these pieces interact, knowing that ultimately the data will be a reflection of how people feel coming into work because they will be more productive. Are we looking, are our scouting practices right so that we're actually finding the right people? Like, if we do the people part right, we'll create better data. And that ultimately data is a reflection of what happened. And that should be used that way, and then trying to understand how we created those results.
One of my journalistic white whales is I would love, and if Cliff Kingsbury or Joe Witt Jr. or Dan Quinn is listening,
hey,
like, please,
hey,
feel free. But I would love to understand, like, is there a play call where the data says you should pass, or you should run, or you should run this type of pass. I would love to understand when a decision maker has all that data, is appreciating that data, not dismissing it, but then defies the data because they feel something in their gut, or they see on the sideline, or they see, you know, from the booth, hey, like, my right tackle is dominating this end, and, like, we think that Jaden, like, can get out to the right, or whatever, you know, the quarterback. I think that, like, the key is not allowing the data, like you said, to just drive the decisions. But I feel like we don't hear enough stories about the people in charge appreciating the data and then making a decision.
I have a great story for you from Sean.
Okay, let's hear that.
So when Sean was here, which this becomes extra funny considering where Sean went, right?
Sean McVay.
As in Sean McVay.
Yeah,
yes. And he talked about, I can't remember if he said in a press conference or where there was, like, me, him, and Keim talking. And of course, Keim was there because John Keim, he's always there. But, like, Sean was like, you know, we have data that might suggest that on 4th and 1, we should go for it. It's 70%. We're going to get it. And especially, you know, for us, it's like go over the left tackle or the left guard. But we're playing the Rams this week, and over the left guard is Aaron Donald. And by the way, our left guard is injured, and now we're on our backup. And it's like, the data doesn't change. The data still says it's 72%. The data's not factoring that in. We're like, that's Aaron Donald. I'm not running Aaron Donald.
Right.
And, like, it's funny because he then went and got Aaron Donald, won a Super Bowl with Aaron Donald. But, like, that kind of stuff, yeah, I think absolutely. And then, like, I think the fun thing is to then zoom out and be like, okay, how does that principle apply to the ownership level? Like, how are these billionaires who often have gotten ahead financially because they are ahead of the curve on the data, they see where it's going, like, how many of them actually apply that well to football? And I think that's the hard part. And I don't know how many of them are doing it well. What I do seem to be able to figure out is that the family owner types are getting left behind. That the Steelers and the Giants and the Cowboys and, like, these guys that have been in it for 30 years, like, I don't know that they're adapting nearly as well as some of the more innovative teams. Or even someone like Bisciotti in Baltimore, who's kind of, he's been around for a long time at this point, but has always made it on being a little bit ahead of everybody else.
Well, I think it's ironic in the NFL also because, like, one of the most analytical forward teams is the Cleveland Browns and their GM.
Yeah, they stink.
Like, if you watch Moneyball,
yeah,
like the Jonah Hill character,
yeah,
Paul DePodesta is in the Cleveland Browns front
right.
office. And, like, by all accounts,
look at any future GM list, and there's, like, 4 Browns people on it every single year.
Right. Like, they're generally considered a smart organization, but the owner gave like the craziest contract in the NFL to a quarterback who has not been a productive quarterback. I'll leave that discussion there. But, like, to me, that's ownership needing to work with the front office. And I think that everybody understands you need a quarterback, and they made that decision because they thought Deshaun Watson could be that quarterback. But that's the sort of thing where if you miss on that, like, you have the potential to tank your franchise. And so I would say something interesting to me is from the Commanders offseason, and just because, like, that's the thing that I'm, you know, yeah, most tapped in on. But, like, when I see them, and obviously there's other factors at play, but if you looked at in a vacuum, Benjamin St. Juice and Dante Fowler Jr., 2 defenders, they have high athleticism scores. They test well. Their numbers look good. But then if you look at Dietrich Wise Jr., defensive end, and Jonathan Jones, the corner, like those guys maybe aren't testing as well.
Yeah.
But I think when you watch the tape, they're more reliable. They do their assignments more. And I think that, you know, really it showed up setting the edge in the run game last year. Like Dante Fowler Jr. was not as consistent. Dietrich Wise Jr., very consistent in terms of what his responsibility was. And so to me, like those two signings, trading those two guys is a reflection not of ownership level, but of a GM level saying, hey, these guys are going to be more reliable, even if they're not as good athletically. Like, that's fine. We'll take that because we need reliability.
Let's explain the difference in cash and cap, which sounds really like simple, but probably people are like, wait, what's the difference? Like when a contract comes through, how does the cash flow work versus the cap flow work?
So the cash flow is basically literally the money. Like if I hand you a dollar, that's cash flow. Salary cap is accounting. So if I give you a dollar, I can add a void year onto that contract. So then the dollar is, you know, split in half. Or I can manipulate the accounting by using the salary cap. And I want to use a disclaimer that I'm like, the salary cap is incredibly complicated. Brandon Sosna, there are a lot of people in organizations that are paid, you know, to understand the cap. I am not an expert, but this is like I do feel like I have a handle on the layman's terms of like, this is how this stuff works.
Right. And so the easiest example always is your base salary on a given year. Let's say that the salary is guaranteed, like that's part of your cap number, and the signing bonus is split between the number of years. So if we say that I'm going to give player X the high number, right, is 2 years, $10 million, right? But we say $10 million of that is base salary split between 2 years. Okay. But we can manipulate that in a second. And then there's a $10 million signing bonus. Automatically, the cap number is going to be $5 million year one, $5 million year two in prorated signing bonus. That's the cap number plus however we split the salary. So we could just make it $10 million each year and do five and five there. But we could say, let's go low base salary in the first year, $2 million. Now our first year cap number is $7 million. Our second year cap number is now, what is that? I said $2 million, so $8 million plus the five is 13. And if we cut that player, because actually that's a roster bonus for the second year, that's how we save $8 million because we don't actually get to that second million. And then that $5 million that was prorated in the second year becomes dead cap money. I think I just did that correctly off the top of my head. I'm famously bad at math, but I think that's how you kind of get the not just cap versus cash explained in terms of like what the definitions are, but how that actually plays out in a fairly simple example in practice.
That was very impressive.
I've done
for
that,
someone who's like really bad at math, like that was
I kept
some good
the numbers
mapping.
pretty simple. And we're fresh off free agency. My math brain is sharp.
To me, I would dumb it down even further because I can't say the numbers into the microphone and keep it all in my head like you just did.
Literally had an over the cap slash spo track like chart in my head as I was doing that, and I was moving the whatever. You do your simple version.
The simplest version to me is cash spending per year is a measure of aggressiveness. And it's easier to be high in cash spending every year if you have a highly paid quarterback. Like I just pulled up over the caps, cash spending isn't working. Jason, if you're listening, please.
We got a lot of people that may be listening. We got the coordinators. We got Jason and over the cap. Who else? Shout them out.
My mom.
Sam's mom, famous character on the radio show.
Exactly. On SpoTrack, like if you look at the teams that are top five in cash spending, you know, you got only one of them, Minnesota, doesn't have a highly paid quarterback. Otherwise, it's Buffalo, Cleveland, Philly, Kansas City. So it's easier to be high in cash spending with a quarterback. But to me, like the thing that I was looking at this year for the Commanders in free agency is Adam Peters and Josh Harris said, hey, we understand the value of Jaden Daniels' rookie contract. We really want to make use of that. We want to, you know, come in and like really hit that window. And so to me, it's like, okay, what's your cash spending then? And so they started, you know, free agency at 20th because they didn't have a lot of players under contract. Now, according to SpoTrack, which differs from over the cap, but you know, we'll use it. They're 15th. They have $260 million committed, which obviously will, you know, they'll sign more players. They'll draft players and potentially like make other moves that could boost it. But like, I think 15th, when you consider that Jaden Daniels is not on a big, you know, contract, okay, maybe like that's acceptable. But that to me, if you're a fan, looking at where they rank in cash spending is a good measure of Adam Peters' aggressiveness to maximize this window. And I think that if you're a fan and you say, hey, like, we're 15th, why aren't we higher? I'm sure Adam Peters could have, oh, the free agent class wasn't great. Or, oh, you know, if Ronnie Stanley had made it to the market, we would have paid him a lot of money. But he didn't. So we had to trade for Laremy Tunsil. And, like, that contract is different. So
right. You don't take on a lot of cash on that contract because this was the last part to my very convoluted or maybe not that convoluted example is, like, when you pay the signing bonus, you pay the cash right now. It's a signing bonus. It just counts on the cap in parts later. And so, for instance, Laremy Tunsil, his $21 million cap hit is different than the cash they have to give him, especially, and then like part of that is the dead money in Houston because they already paid him the signing bonus and they already paid that cash. So Washington is essentially getting Laremy Tunsil at a discount from a cash standpoint, I mean, and a cap standpoint, but a cash standpoint especially because they don't have to pay any of the signing bonus that's already been paid to him 3 years ago when he signed the deal.
Exactly. And that's why when you look at the Eagles, not only do they have a highly paid quarterback and they're paying linebacker Zach Bond, they're paying a lot of different people. Jeffrey Lurie, the owner, is saying, okay, I am willing to cut these checks to keep the cash flowing out, you know, out the door every year. And the cash spending can go over the salary cap spending. So you'll see, you know, a team, you know, team spending $300 million, even though the salary cap's lower than that. Like, that's why ownership is important because, like, Lurie is saying, hey, like, we want to keep Zach Bond. He's important to our team. We're willing to pay the cash. And so I think that's, and you know, you see some other moves, you know, like getting rid of CJ Gardner-Johnson, the safety, because it's like, hey, like we know Jalen Carter and some of these younger guys on our defense or, you know, on our offense are, we're going to have to pay them. And so I think what Howie Roseman has done has been very impressive because he balances the long-term and short-term. And he has an owner that's willing to spend the money. And so Adam Peters, I think in an ideal world, would get to that level where he's moving around, he's seeing value opportunities, he's taking them. But it requires everybody being on the same page and it requires everyone investing.
So let's play that out over a multi-year scenario, right? Like, how does that actually cost? Because I think a lot of times teams look at it, or fans look at it, and I look at it sometimes this way too. So I'm with you on this one. I look at it from a cap perspective, right? And I go, yes, did you pay Devontae Smith, AJ Brown, et cetera, as soon as you possibly could versus maybe potentially negotiating, whatever. And but in a couple of years, it winds up being a bargain on the cap because you pay them early and then other guys get signed. And now all of a sudden, instead of them being the highest paid receiver in football, within a year, they're the fifth, sixth, seventh. And they just keep going down the list until they want an extension again. So how does that allow, like, one, how does that allow them to keep multiple players when you do that cap gymnastics over and over again? Like, why does it tend to work out that paying guys early allows you to keep the cap more flexible? And two, why does that wind up costing the owner more money from a cash perspective?
Great question. And I think that Jerry Jones would have a great answer on this because his negotiating tactic is just like wait as long
as possible and then pay what you would have paid anyway, except for $20 million more, even though Dak Prescott, the only thing that happened between when you didn't pay him and you did was he got hurt. What? Sorry.
No. It's very good.
Mystifying.
The most basic reason for why you can continue to do that is like, through wars and economic downturns and COVID, like the cap keeps going up. Like the value of the media rights keeps going up. It is
Netflix comes in, is like, here's a new fresh Billy for you.
It is unbelievable, man. And I am not smart enough to understand the big picture economics of like, is this a bubble? Will it ever burst? Or will it just keep going up? But so I think that the reason why teams have been less afraid of just splashing the pot, basically, to use a poker analogy, is like the cap is going to keep going up and we're going to figure out ways around it. You know, like we are going to figure out ways accounting wise. Like that's why you pay, you know, the director of football administration or whatever that title is to understand the cap and to manipulate it. And I think it's just really, it's what tools do we have at our disposal to figure that out? And so like Andrew Wiley with the Commanders this year, like you restructure his contract, you know, take a pay cut or, you know, with Debo, you know, you convert certain money into guarantees or incentives. Like you can play these things around to build the best team and to keep your cap in the right financial health. But it all goes back to cash. It all goes back to what is the owner willing to cut the check on? And I think that to kind of zoom out a little bit, a thing that I'm fascinated by is you see a lot of these old school owners, you know, the family run businesses, they have struggled to keep up with the spending with the franchise valuations. And so you see, you know, hey, like we're going to sell X% minority stake to a person or a private equity firm or, you know, these institutional backers. And so my question is, where does the, like, how far does this go? Like, if you're a fan of the Steelers or a fan of the Giants or the Chargers, you know, or the Cardinals, owned by like some of these original old owners, to what extent do they sell to the private equity people so that, you know, we can keep the money going up, we can stay competitive?
It's a great question, and I think it's one of the fascinating things about the Harris Group. Like, they have like an obscene amount of
20
minority partners, many of whom are extremely cash rich, and like, I don't know, and I don't know if you know, the rules in terms of like what they're able to contribute in cash. Like, is it, or do they have to contribute their percent ownership, or like, can you almost like, can Josh Harris take a loan out from, what is it, the Chilean family that's worth like $50 billion that has an, like a whatever point percent ownership stake? Can they just be like, hey guys, we need to pay Debo. You want to get this one? Like, which is like when we go to lunch and it's like, hey, do you want to split the check? We're trying to figure out our salads and they're trying to figure out how to pay multi-million dollar football players. I don't know the rules on that.
Credit card roulette for Jaden Daniels' next contract would be incredible.
Did you see, by the way, J.I. Halsell, I think he was on with B. Mitch and Finley the other day, said he thinks that Jaden's going to be the first $90 million guy.
It's hard to imagine, but I mean, you see the contracts that guys are getting now. Like,
we're almost at 70.
But if you can start negotiating that contract in 2027, that's, you know, that's two more years. I don't know. I mean,
90 feels a little rich.
He knows more about the cap than I do. I would never argue with him about that. But I guess at some point, quarterbacks in 2010 were probably like $50 million for a quarterback per year. No way. And now it's like, oh, that's actually not even that bad.
No. And that's the thing, is like, the Netflix money really has messed it up in a great way. Like, it's gone up so much more each year that, like, you know, going back to what I was talking about with the, how does it become a bargain, is like, well, when I found the agent and I was like, all right, I want to make sure that by the end of this contract, we're still at X percent of the cap and like, we're not going to be screwed. And then all of a sudden the cap is 20% higher than we anticipated. And now it's like, you're stealing some of these contracts that are 2 years old, because you anticipated the cap being $40 million lower than it actually is, because it went up an additional like $20 million each year the last 2 years. And so it changes everything. And, you know, we talked about this during the free agency period too, is like, part of the reason the free agency class was so bad is like, anybody who was remotely good, their incumbent team thought, okay, I'm not going to be able to keep this guy. Oh, wait, there's that much extra money to float around in the cap? We have that much flexibility? Hey, ownership, we just need a little bit of extra cash. Okay, cool. And as long as the ownership was able to come through, so Bashotti is like, yeah, I'll sign the check for Ronnie Stanley. What's his name? With the mustache out in L.A. Kroenke, he's willing to sign the money for Alaric Jackson. And all of a sudden, there's two left tackles that the Commanders were looking at that are off the market. And it's like, Josh Harris is sitting there with his checkbook. Like, I was ready too, but Adam never came knocking, because there just wasn't anybody to spend the money on.
Right, and I think one of the advantages of being a GM, or one of the skills that you can have, I think, is probably projecting like, what's that salary cap going to be? Because then that informs, if you're, I think a great example of this is Javon Kinlaw. People were saying, oh my God, what an overpay, 3 for $45. It's different than that, but like, that's the, you know, full value of the contract. If you use him more as a pass rusher than as a interior nose tackle, then I think the contract looks different. And also, if you project, okay, if we think the cap is going to do this next year and this next year, then that's a totally different contract as well. Like, looking at things not as dollar figures, but as percentages of the cap. Like, I play a lot of poker, and like, I always look at it at my chip stack as, how many big blinds do I have? Not how many dollars do I have, but like, if I'm playing in a tournament and the blind is going to go from 200 to 400, it's like, okay, like, that changes my stack significantly. So if I know that if I'm going to go from 30 big blinds to 15 big blinds, I'm going to have to be more aggressive in the last 3 minutes of when I have more spending power, or that, you know, that's how I would play it. Because if you get too low, then you can't have diminishing return. This is not a podcast about me playing poker. So
it is now.
But I do think there is an analogy there, in terms of, what is my purchasing power and what is it going to be in the future? And how do I then maximize what I have now?
No, that's the part that is also like, where the Commanders are specifically, right? I don't care if they overspend on Javon Kinlaw, if they want Javon Kinlaw on the team. Like, that is separate than should they want Javon Kinlaw on the team.
Yes.
Right? That is a separate question. But, like, they got money to burn. And, like, one, I don't count other people's money. So the cash side of it, which is the only thing an owner cares about, I don't care about it at all. Because I, as an analyst, am interested in the team building side. I am interested in the cap number and how the pieces fit together. From a cap standpoint, Commanders have all the money in the world to play with. Javon Kinlaw being overpaid is not going to cost them a single player. So at that point, you're making a decision of, do we want to slightly overpay? Let's just use the flat numbers. I know the contract is more detailed than this, but if I'm paying Javon Kinlaw $15 million a year, and I'm only going to get $12 million of production, but the next best option was a guy I could have gotten for eight, even if I got $8 million of production, well, now I've lost the gap between the $8 million and the $12 million, even if I'm overpaying the $12 million worth of production, however you want to do that, put that in your AI model and smoke it, at $15 million. And like that becomes the decision if the cap is well managed of like, you can say like, you know what? We got the room. We'll overpay because we think that guy is worth having on our team. And the gap between him and our next best option is significant enough. It's significant enough that we will eat the difference in projection here. And then we'll do everything in our power to try to maybe have him have a career year and actually, you know, wind up being a true underpay or whatever you want to look at it as.
This is, I think, the alchemy of team building. Where it gets really fascinating is sort of in the same way with analytics. Like, once you have all the financial information, then you have to figure out, when do I deviate from that? Or, you know, what is the exception to the rule? And I'm going to make like kind of a left turn here, but I covered the Nationals in 2019, the Washington mm-hmm. Nationals. They won the World Series, but they started 19-31. And I think that a really key part of like what made that team special, and I thought, you know, Mike Rizzo, the GM, made some, you know, shrewd moves, is a lot of baseball teams, because the analytics movement was so far along, were just basically using, I felt like, looking around the league, using the spreadsheet to dictate, you know, oh, we want all these young players to have all these at-bats, and we want them to be on these contracts, and they're going to produce X war, blah, blah, blah. But Mike Rizzo, you know, grizzled scout, not a Wall Street guy, like, he understood, oh, you need veterans in the locker room. So, yeah. Like, Howie Kendrick, you know, kind of a modestly paid veteran, like, sat near Juan Soto, and, you know, they had other guys throughout the clubhouse. And so when they start 19-31, you have sort of veteran presences who are able to say, like, hey, like, chill out. Like, we'll be fine. Like, we, you know, we just got to go one at-bat at a time, or whatever, like, cliche they wanted to use, that ultimately ended up being a truism where they get back in the hunt and they win the World Series. Like, I think that veteran, like Howie Kendrick, I think was undervalued by the baseball market because he had a skill that was hard to put on a spreadsheet, which is he was a professional hitter who was a good mentor and a good clubhouse guy. And I think that another good example of this is I just read the book by Yaron Weitzman. I'm forgetting the title. I think it was Tanking to the Top, maybe. Okay. It's about the 76ers. But when Josh Harris takes over, Josh Harris's group takes over and they hire Sam Hinkie, the biggest thing to me was Sam Hinkie's process mathematically made a lot of sense. But if you're going to use a really high pick on Nerlens Noel, not just, you know, a center with injury history, but also, I did not realize this, but the book really laid out, there were a lot of immaturity concerns.
Mm.
And they stripped the roster down, and they didn't have a veteran who could get him to the team plane on time, or to stop him from going out the night before he needed to, like, do rehab or things like that. And so, you know, when they installed Brian Colangelo, who you know, had his own problems.
Eventually that didn't go great.
But I do think that there is some value in, hey, we have a lot of young, talented players.
Yeah.
We need veterans in there to show them how it's done. Like, Bobby Wagner had an incalculable impact on Jaden this year.
Right.
Like, I don't even know all those details, but you could just tell in terms of preparation, in terms of, like, hey, getting used to the league. Like, he had, and Zach Ertz, like, those guys who you look like, who I looked at in the first free agent signing, I was like, I don't know. Like, $5 million for Zach Ertz, like, he might not even make the team. He ends up doing a lot more in the field than you expect. But even if he didn't,
right,
it's really important that they're in there, Super Bowl champions, guys that know how to do it. That is, I just think that there is an incalculable value, and it's up to Adam Peters and GMs around the league to figure out, what is that worth to us?